If you're building one of these, please reach out to me. I want to invest in all of these. I want to invest in like 20 of these companies.
I feel like I can rule the world. I know I could be what I want to. I put my all in it like no days off. On the road, let's travel, never looking back.
So we're going to talk about what you guys can expect in today's episode. But before we do, so my first million, we actually just went from 80th in our category on the iTunes store, which is a big deal to us, to like number 14. And one of the reasons why we did it was because you folks who are listening have clicked the subscribe button. So if you're using iTunes or using an Apple product, can you please do me a favor? I want you to go and click subscribe. So go to our My First Million page and click that subscribe button. And then we have this email address. MFM, so My First Million, MFM@thehustle.co. Send a screenshot of you subscribed, and we're going to do a call out of you on the podcast. So say like your name and then show me that you subscribed. Send it to MFM, a screenshot, and we're going to give a call out. And actually, we're going to give a call out at the end of this episode for all the people that did that previously. And now let's hear what we're going to talk about in this episode. Go ahead, Sean.
We got a bunch of topics I'm excited about. We talked about creating barstool sports for the tech industry. We talked about internal company podcasting platforms like Spoken. We went on a crazy detour for crime walks, manhood as a service, rent a chicken. We got a bunch of good topics in this week's, in today's episode. This was probably, if you like ideas, I would say you're going to love this episode. Sometimes we're a little bit light on ideas. We were super heavy on ideas today. So I think you guys will love it.
Great. See you in the episode. So we were talking for a few minutes about the podcast updates and what we're doing to make it grow. But what I was about to tell you, Sean, is I have this doc that I'm going to send to you. And so, you know, have you seen how, I don't know if you've seen this or not, but the podcast goes in the email, I think every day now.
Oh, and I have not seen that. Yeah.
And I'm the one writing it. And so I have we set this up. So it's going to, you're going to see the clicks in this document that I sent you every day. But anyway, it's going well today. Did you see that graph I sent you?
I tweeted it out. I was like, this is what I'm talking about. You sent a graph of the iTunes rankings for us, business, for the business category, I guess. Pretty big category. And
maybe the
we
biggest.
Usually hovered between 80 and 100. Like we were number 80, number 100, I guess. Like that was kind of like our norm. And then Sam takes over growth and like, boom, step change. We're up to, we're now ranked number 20 for the last, I don't know, week or two. You could just see when you started working on it. It's like a direct thing, which reminds me of like a very, a lesson I always teach everybody on our team, because there's lots of marketing things you'll do where you're like, did it work? And it's like, I don't know. We got to look into it. Oh, it wasn't trackable. It's like, no. Just show me the revenue graph. Show me the user graph. Like if I can't notice something happened on this day or, hey, we started growing around this time, then it didn't work enough, right? Like, because usually when you're in a small project, you need step changes. You don't need 1%. You need 10%, 30%, 50% type of changes to work.
And basically where we are now is, I mean, you and I are both very capable of doing this. You just kind of look at it takes about 2 weeks. It took me about 2 weeks to talk to people and to look at the numbers. And it's like, oh, okay. I now know that if I only do this, I'm going to be mostly there.
Right.
And what I've learned now is it's getting people to click the subscribe button on iTunes. If I get people to do that, mostly everything will be fine.
Okay, but that's going to sound overly simplistic. It's like, yeah, all I got to do is get checkmate and then I win a game of chess. It's like, well, yeah, but how do you get people to click the subscribe button is kind of the question.
I mean, it is not overly simplistic. It is simple. It is get people to click that button. Now, the not simple part is how I'm going to get people to click the button.
Right.
But the way to grow is simple. I just get people to click that button. And we've got loads of ways. For one, I'm just asking people. So
yeah.
we asked people to leave a review the other day. And when I asked people to leave the review, that day we had 600 reviews. Do you know how many reviews we have now?
I don't know. There's at least a few hundred that came through. Yeah.
1,400.
Okay, so we added 800 reviews just off of a quick 1 minute ask. Hey, if you like the podcast, go review it. We really appreciate it. That's kind of all you offered, really.
It wasn't quick. I like begged and I begged them, but yeah.
Right. It was sincere.
Yes.
What I'm saying is it wasn't like rocket science. So you know, I guess like one of the reasons I want to share how we grow this podcast is because the way we grow this podcast is kind of going to be, hold on, mosquito on my desk. No, too slow. Okay.
All right. A quick message from our sponsor, which is, of course, HubSpot. Now, look, growing a business is tough, and it's tough because a lot of times you have to duct tape a ton of software together to make it work. I've been there, and it's a pain in the butt. You have this thing connecting to that thing, and the two things that are being connected, one of them breaks, or the thing connecting them doesn't work, and it's a mess. You have all these moving parts, and it's just a pain in the butt because you don't know where the single source of truth is. And that's where HubSpot's customer platform comes into play. Finally, you've got this single source of truth where everything is organized and tracked in one place. For example, if you have customers emailing you, they've got really easy ways to see who on your team is replying to which customer, what they're saying, and things like that. And you can track it all in one place. They also have a lot of AI-supported stuff, which means that you can automatically know which type of messaging you need to send to that type of customer. And yes, it sounds natural, like a real person. I actually use it. I use it with my company, Hampton, and it works wonderfully. And when leads come in, you know which channel they came through, you know who's going to follow up with them, and it's all seamless and easy. So if you're interested, it's simple. Go to HubSpot.com and check it out and see how you can use it to grow your business.
So one of the ways that we're going to grow this podcast, or one of the reasons we talk about this, is because the things you're doing now is stuff that people can learn to grow whatever their thing is. And so I would say, so far, two observations. Number one, intensity. When Sam does something, he really like throws himself in a, you know, a more intense way than the average person. The average person thinks they're doing it. And then we watch Sam's level of like aggression and intensity towards something. And you're like, oh, okay. That's what a level 12 is. Like now I know what the sort of theoretical max is. Okay. So that's one lesson. I get to see, I guess other people don't get to see on a daily basis, but whatever. Second thing is start with the stupid, simple stuff. Okay. We want subscribers. Well, have we just asked people to subscribe? Right? Like, have we tweeted saying, go subscribe? Have we said it on the podcast? Hey, make sure you subscribe to this thing. Go push this button. And that takes zero effort, but actually yielded like gain because it was just low hanging fruit. And I know that a lot of smart people would have talked themselves out of that because they would be afraid to ask anybody for anything. They're just afraid of getting rejected, afraid of coming across as a, you know, salesperson or beggar or whatever. So they're just afraid to ask. And secondly, they would have overcomplicated things. They would have said, well, I got to go do this sophisticated strategy. And it's like, wait, well, have you tried the dumb strategy first?
Yes, I completely agree. And like, that's why I always make a joke that when I meet really smart people, like we interviewed biology the other day, and I don't know when that's going to come out in relation to this, when this podcast is coming out, but soon. And he was like one of the most high IQ people I've ever spoke to. I think he might have been the highest IQ person I've ever talked to. And it was very obvious. And when I was talking to him, I actually was wondering, I'm like, you know, for the longest time, I actually thought that the lower your IQ, like you want your IQ to be just above average, but not really high, because the really smart people I meet other than him, they typically talk themselves out of anything. And and so anyway, I actually think that being just slightly above average is optimal.
But that's the sweet spot.
I didn't get to ask him that, but I would love to know his opinion of that, of like, because like when you meet him, and he must know that he's like a kind of a genius,
right? He can't not say kinda. It because, you know, he's gonna be humble about it. He's not gonna say, yeah, clearly I'm smarter than everybody, but he is clearly smarter than everyone.
So I know where you're going with this top one, and I think I've got a strong opinion on it. You want to do your bar stool for tech?
Yes.
We've talked about this many times.
Okay. Yeah. So maybe we'll keep it short. But
well, I don't know. I mean, I know what you said, but all listeners, they probably don't.
Okay. So Barstool to me is a super interesting company. Not just I'm a fan. I consume some of the content, but I'm more interested in the business behind it. So they basically went into sports media, which was dominated by ESPN. And they, you know, the upstart made it. They started with nothing. Literally, Dave Portnoy was, writing a newspaper himself and then going down to the subway and handing it out to people before they got on their morning commute. That was the humble origins of that. Not even like a blog, like a physical newspaper he was handing out, like the paper boy, and he was the writer, and he was the editor, right? And so that's how we got started. And then ultimately, you know, they sold for, I don't even, you probably know, 600, 700 million.
650-ish.
Yeah. So great outcome. And like, you know, they actually mean something in the world. A lot of people really love Barstool. They care about Barstool. Great. So why doesn't this exist in the world of business or the world of tech? So what did Barstool do? And could you apply that here? So what Barstool did, if you listen to Dave's early interviews, he basically says, look, we are an entertainment company. So that's the first thing. We are trying to make people laugh and have a good time. If you go to ESPN, that's not their mindset. Their mindset is news, information, analysis. And yes, we are entertainment, but like we're entertainment through news, information, official games and analysis. And Barstool has no rights to the games. They don't bid for it. They don't own any NBA games. They don't know NFL games. They don't do much analysis. They don't do much sort of information. They don't tell you the news. They don't tell you who won and lost and how many points the guy scored. But they really focus on that last bit, which is making people laugh and being entertained. And so I think the world of business is full of ESPNs. It's full of information, analysis, like official broadcasts of content, whether it's, interviews with the companies and whatever. I think somebody should make Barstool for Tech, which is, I'm here to make you laugh. You're into the business world. You're into the tech world, the startup world, whatever it is, pick your niche. And every day we're going to report news that makes you laugh. And today there's like The Onion that does that. So I would say that's like an example of someone who does that. But they're very extreme and maybe that's the right way to go. There was like kind of Valley Wag or these kind of gossip blogs. So they took gossip and they brought it to business and tech. They kind of got sued out of business later, but they were popular for a time. And there's kind of nobody else. And I think that if there is a Dave Portnoy out there, if there's somebody who's interested in this stuff and they're funny as hell, or they have this comedic taste, you could build a media company doing this. That's my theory. I feel like you disagree. Give me your take.
Yeah. So I don't disagree with you. I think it would work if you could pull it off. I want to explain to you why this is hard to pull off. So when you're a sports journalist who happens to be funny, which I actually think a lot of those people start, they're like, they love sports and they happen to be funny. And, right. And that's typically how it works. Now, you don't really have that many options. You can work for the local newspaper. You can try to get one of the few jobs at ESPN. But regardless, if you're lucky, you make $150,000 a year, right?
Right. And you're tabling the comedy side 9 times out of 10. You're like, I would say this joke in my text message group with my buddies, but I can't put it in my column on ESPN.
If you're smart enough to do this for business and you're funny, here's the rub. You likely can get paid a ton of money as some type of analyst or some type of investor or some type of operator.
Right.
And so it's really hard to retain those types of people because they say, well, why would I make, like, if I'm this smart, I'm just going to go and trade stocks or invest in companies or start a company versus give you my opinion and make you laugh for $80,000.
Right.
And this is the problem I've always had at The Hustle, which is how do you actually, like, a lot of the people who are best at analyzing companies and giving opinions, they sold their company for $80 million. And so I have found it's quite hard to retain those people. Whereas if you are a journalist in sports, that's like the end goal is to be a journalist in sports.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Whereas when you cover this stuff, the end goal is to start or join an early stage company that's going to be massive. And so, okay, so I agree with you that you could pull this off, or that if you could pull it off, it would be a huge hit. It's just that's one of the hard parts.
Right. So I agree with you. There are there's higher opportunity cost for a smart business person who has a good sense of humor to do many things. But here's the kicker. I think this could be fun. I think this could be cool. And I think that there's enough people out there that aren't going to know how to parlay their, you kind of need just above average IQ and then 2 standard deviations above average, like kind of internet funniness. To make this work. And so here's my pitch. Well, here's the camera. I got to look at Trung. I'm looking at you. Trung, look into these eyes. I'm looking at you right now. Trung, this is what you should do, my friend. You need to leave The Hustle. You need to leave HubSpot and you need to create the Barstool for Tech. You already are doing it on Twitter and you need to create it. But here's the kicker. Here's how you make it more valuable. It's not just a media company. This would actually be an investment fund. So you would be a VC fund whose brand is built through journalism, whose distribution of how they help their companies is through their media arm. And so you're a media arm whose business model is your VC fund.
And that's actually what I was going to say is I think that would work. But you need to be a VC fund first who then hires content people and offers them like some upside there.
You're a VC fund in disguise is kind of how I would start it. Because you do have to build up, you know, good distribution. And it's not, again, I don't think it would be hard because there's nobody really creating this type of content. There's nobody that will just straight up make fun of Zuck when he's talking like a robot somewhere, right? Like, and that's the type of stuff that Deadspin and Barstool that they do. They find funny, memeable moments and they talk about them. And that's why Trunk came to mind, because he did a tweet the other day about Steve Ballmer, and it was like information. It was like, Steve Ballmer, did you know when he first joined Microsoft, this was his salary, and then he renegotiated and was able to get this much equity that turned him into a 30 billionaire or whatever he is now. And by the way, he did the whole thing, and he has this like Steve Ballmer in 4 decades, and each time he's wearing the same white, you know, New Balance dad shoes. And he's like, he did this the whole time wearing these New Balance shoes, like anything is possible. And I was like, this is the perfect blend of a useful information nugget wrapped in a joke poking fun at the bear. And so I think that's the model. So anyways, I'm bullish on this. Sorry for trying to poach, trying to convince him to go do this, but I think that would be the ultimate manifestation of his talents, or somebody who's like Trunk. If you're the next Trunk out there, I don't know you.
So I'm not saying Trunk is this. I'm also not saying Trunk is not this, but when you hire these types of people, because what makes them good also makes them a pain in the ass to work with sometimes. You know, like what makes them good is that they're hilarious. They come up with stuff like off the cuff, but they're incredibly challenging to contain. Yes. And you don't want to contain them necessarily, but like there is some shit you need people to do.
I'm kind of like this, right? I showed up 10 minutes late today. I know you hate me being late. I wasn't trying to be late, but I'm late. But also, I'm good at what I do. You could find somebody who shows up on time for the podcast, but it's hard to find somebody who's going to consistently create great content.
Right.
And that is that's the rub with talent.
I've learned how to put up with that, but right. That is the part where sometimes I'm like, ugh, I should just start a software company where the code is never late and the code never complains about X, Y, and Z. Saying this isn't a Trunk. Trunk, I love you. This is just me as well. General. I'm a creative person as well. I'm like that. And so creative people are hard to contain. You want to talk about slips? Because you were interested in this one.
Okay, so check out...
Dude, why do you always say, I don't think you're going to like... Am I like a default negative Nancy?
I posted it in Slack and you go, I hate course businesses. So that's what I'm basing this on. You're like, why are you saying I hate this? Like, you literally told me an hour ago.
Like,
you
hate this. a company that publishes courses, I think, is awesome to own, horrible to invest in. Am I wrong?
I don't know. Maybe. What do you mean, company that publishes courses? So who's that? Like, what? Like
Teachable? Teachable is a platform.
Right. This is a platform. So let me explain what this is. So, the domain is slip.so, and it's a company I'm looking at potentially investing in. I saw it and it immediately was like, oh, this is a smart idea. So what did they do? They make it easy for any developer to create a course to teach, you know, some programming, you know, either a language or how to make X or how to make X go faster or whatever, right? Any developer teaching other developers. So why do you need a new platform for this? Why can't you just use Udemy or Udacity or one of the other 10 platforms? Well, those platforms are all teaching through video. So you upload a video and maybe some text or PDF, and then people go take that course self-serve. What they did was a little bit different. They took the best ways to learn how to code online are interactive. Like we talked about Codecademy, or is it Code Academy? I don't know, but Codecademy.com.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it fast so you don't know what I'm saying, if I'm saying it right or wrong. Codecademy.com. You go there. I think they have like 40 million users or something. It's, you know, it's really grown over time.
It's a thing.
And all it is it's a, like, you don't have to have, it's the, like, if you ever tried to learn how to code, first you got to download the text editor. That's what you're going to use to write your code in. Then you got to download like the Python packages. So you can like deploy, and you're like, what the fuck is all this? I don't even know what Python is yet. But you need that to get started. So what Codecademy did that was brilliant was they just put it all in the website, all in the browser. So you go to the website, there's a place to type, and you don't have to install anything, you don't have to download anything. It just says, look, write variable equals A. Now you made a variable called A. Fantastic. That's, you know, level one, complete. Level two, let's do A plus one. And like you do it. And if you get it wrong, a little hint pops up. It's like a game. A hint pops up and says, type A plus one. So anyways, or you're missing a comma or whatever. So so Codecademy built this and they are a teacher. So what Slip did was they made a platform, but they made the Codecademy like sandbox or toolkit available for any dev. So let's say I'm a developer and I'm really good at front-end development and making parallax scrolling websites. So I want to teach that, but I don't want to have to build the underlying infrastructure that Code Academy built in order to just let students come learn from me. That's way too much work. So what this is it's Code Academy in a box. Any developer can now create an interactive course and teach other developers, and they can make money for sharing what they know. So I think this is pretty cool. I like the idea of letting developers become teachers. I think we're going to want more programmers over time. And I think that the building that underlying sandbox, that infrastructure that lets anybody have this kind of like Code Academy in a box, I think is a cool innovation that's going to save people a lot of time. So I'm kind of bullish on this, but it's very, very early. There's not much traction. It just got started. What do you think?
Well, have you done the math behind this? Like how many?
So he charges, I think if you are a developer who's using it, I think he charges $30 a month plus 10% of the sales for your course. That's his business model. He himself taught a course. So how did he arrive here? He created a course on learning Vim. I don't even know what Vim is, but it's some shit developers use. So Vim's like it's basically like it's kind of like your virtual machine, basically how you organize and write your code, I think. Or maybe it's something completely different. Sean doesn't know. So he created a Vim course. And in order to do that, he built the infrastructure for himself so that his students would have an interactive way to learn this instead of just watching videos and trying to figure it out themselves. They'd have a sandbox to go and write the code to learn. He made $10,000, $15,000 selling that course. And then he was like, oh, dude, I should make this so that any developer, like I know Vim, but what about the next guy who knows Solidity and they're trying to teach Ethereum programmers, how to write in Solidity? They can now create their course using the same toolkit that I used for myself.
So I wish he would have started this like 6 years ago. So right now, these course businesses are actually these course platforms, we're going to call them. They're not publishers. They're tech companies. Right. They're actually booming right now. So do you know a company called Thinkific?
I've heard of it, but it's kind of like a Kajabi, right? It's like a Teachable. It's the same thing, right?
Do you know they went public yesterday?
I did not know this. How big is it?
They went public yesterday on the Canadian Stock Exchange, the Toronto, the TSE. Is that what it's called? The Toronto Stock Exchange? Look it up TSX, right now. For some reason, when companies, right, like in the first couple of days of going public, it's like impossible to find the market cap. I don't understand why it's so hard, but it never shows up. But anyway, they only had $20 million in sales, and they broke even or lost a little bit of money. So they went from $10 million to $20 million in 2020. And guess what their market cap is right now?
It's going to be like, I don't know, $2 billion or something stupid.
It's over $1 billion, their market cap is. And I asked Ankur. So our friend Ankur, he started this company called Teachable. When Teachable sold, they sold for, I think, $250 million. Public information. Just Google. Whatever the headline says, that's what I'm trying to say. Yep. I think it's 250-ish. And I think he was only doing $25 million a year in sales. They had only raised $4 million. It was a really straightforward, simple thing. I mean, hard, but simple. And now Thinkific is quite similar. They went public with a huge, massive valuation. And I was like, Ankur, why are these valuations so high? Like, this is just stupid. And he goes, it's because of, and I don't understand this, but he's like, it's the payments business. So I guess once you get someone to start spending, you save their credit card and then they'll continue buying stuff. And that's one of the reasons why investors value these companies incredibly highly at the moment, is because they want the payments revenue. I don't entirely understand. I don't understand mechanics there, but
the way I would think about it is these are just Shopify. So what did Shopify do? Shopify made it so that anybody can create a storefront. What they're saying is it's Shopify, but instead of selling, hats and shirts, you sell information, which is super high margin. And if you think, okay, Shopify, there are now X number of hundreds of thousands of sellers and Shopify is a $100 billion company. Okay, maybe retail is bigger than the sort of, additional education business. But we have like 100-fold, from 100 billion, which is Shopify, to 1 billion. You can be 100 times smaller than Shopify if you create Shopify for education. If you make it so that any educator can come and create a storefront to sell their information. And that's what Teachable was trying to do. That's what many companies try to do. And they're all splitting that pie in a way. But I like this one because I think it doesn't compete with all those. I think the developer ecosystem, developers teaching other developers or wannabe developers is quite differentiated. And the product is quite differentiated from what Teachable, Kajabi, Thinkific, they're all the same. It's just you create a video library, you charge students, they get access to the library, and then, you know, the teacher can communicate with the students or whatever.
That's how'd you find this guy?
I was on Twitter, I think. I just saw, I don't know, maybe one of my guys sent it to me. I don't really recall. I think Zach, actually, who is my scout for my fund, I think he saw it and was like, this is cool. And I was like, as soon as I went to the landing page, something clicked with me. Now, this is still very small. I think he's under $1,000 of GMB right now. Like, I think he's got like a couple teachers who it's been live for a couple weeks. And, you know, he's
can
got
you
like $1,000
GMB. Name? Peels?
What's that?
What's it called?
Slip.
What's the URL?
Slip.so.
Yeah, look, it's neat. I think I've always had a little bit of a problem with this type of stuff because whenever... Do you know what the finish rate is for courses? You know, it's like 10%.
6%. Yeah.
Like, so 100 people buy it, only 10, if you consider using the product, doing the whole thing, only like 10 of the 100 are actually going to do it if you're lucky.
I have a friend who just sold, he's doing a course. It's a couple $1,000 ticket price, right? So people putting down a few $1,000s to learn this thing. And he said, guess how many people are finishing the course? I was like, oh no, don't tell me. It was like, I think 12 people had finished the course. So it was like, you know, whatever. So less than 6%, I think, had actually finished the course. He also said, guess how many people got to 50%? I think it was like 20 something percent of people had gotten halfway through the course. And he's like, did I make a shitty course? And I was like, no, dude, this is just what self-serve education is. When it's self-serve and there's no peer pressure, there's no like accountable teacher who's like training you every week, or you know, you're showing up to a live thing. When it's Netflix, it's on demand. I can go learn more whenever I want. I paid for the thing. Even paying thousands of dollars is not enough skin in the game to do this. It's very counterintuitive. You would think
it's not even you paid 60 grand a year, or whatever you paid, or someone paid for you to go to Duke, and you miss classes.
Oh yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, I was I basically, you know, for 4 years, I took a 4 year piss down the drain of my college tuition is the way I would describe that experience.
So anyway, that's one of the reasons why I'm not like all gung ho about course businesses, because I'm like, damn, like no one uses your shit.
I'll say this: not all have that low completion rate. I invested in Maven, Guggen's, you know, Guggen Bayani's company. He did Udemy. He saw that low completion rate problem. He created this cohort-based course product where you get a batch of people in. They're going to do the thing for a defined period of time, 5 weeks. There's live instruction every week. And the completion rates are way better, right? Like that dramatically increases it. Lambda School. I invested in Lambda School. Lambda School had like an 80% completion rate when I invested way back in the day. And so I knew something is different about this company. I knew the standard is 6. I knew these guys had 80+. And I was like, what'd you get different? He goes, well, it's live. You show up to class with a bunch of other students and a teacher. And, you know, so, and we do good filtering up top. Most course companies, they're trying to sell as many seats as possible. Lambda School is the opposite. It's like a Harvard. They're trying to only accept the 1% of students that are actually going to do the thing. And so, you know, depending on the business, you can get wildly different outcomes, but yeah, you're right. As a general rule, they're, you know, the usage kind of sucks.
Dude, you have so many ideas here. Where did you find all this? So what the hell is,
you inspired me, dude. You were working on growth, and I was like, if he's doing growth, I better bring the fucking heat on content. So I was like, I'm coming with a bunch of ideas.
What the fuck is Spoken? Sounds sick.
Yes. Okay. You want to do Spoken? So Spoken, S-P-O-K-N. It's podcasting inside companies.
What's the URL?
S-P-O-K-N. I don't know. You'd have to Google it. I don't have the URL.
I did. It's so new, they don't even show up, really.
Oh, shit. Sad, because I'm giving this guy a shout out. They're growing fast.
Got it. So if it's getspoken.com, or if you just Google S-P-O-K-N in quotation marks, you'll find it.
Right. And tell them I sent you. So, okay. So what is this? So when I first started this podcast, I used to record out of a studio and in San Francisco. There's like this old radio station place. And they were like, radio's kind of dying. What if we converted these radio studios to podcast studios? And so they were the only one in San Francisco, if you just like Google for it. It's kind of amazing. $100 an hour, go record. And so I wanted good quality, so I went there. And I used to book like on their little scheduler. And some days I would see it was just like all booked. And I was talking to the dude and I was like, who the hell is booking? How many podcasters are using this thing? I feel like
it was like
not
old,
many people would do. And he was like, oh, sorry, that day, Facebook booked all the hours. I was like, what do you mean Facebook booked all the hours? Facebook doesn't have a podcast. He goes, oh, Facebook has tons of podcasts internally. I was like, what? He goes, yeah, they have like a manager's podcast that is just a internal podcasting podcast for Facebook managers to talk about managing inside Facebook. And I was like, oh, that's actually kind of smart. Like, we've talked about this before, internal media companies. I think this is a big opportunity. You think it's a big opportunity. We've talked about it from a blogging point of view, newsletters. We've talked about it on central announcement dashboards. So building tools for companies to better communicate, build an internal high school newsletter, high school newspaper, I think is what we called it. What is the high school newspaper for your company?
Yeah, I think this is so awesome.
Ever since you said that, I can't get that idea out of my head. If you're building one of these, please reach out to me. I want to invest in all of these. I want to invest in like 20 of these companies.
I'm trying to find that episode. What would I search to find it in Google? My first million internal.
MailChimp for companies, I think. I don't know what we called it at that time, but the core idea is just like a high school or a college will have their school newspaper. Why don't companies have the same? And if it's going to be a newspaper, it's not going to be literally a physical newspaper. In this case, with Spoken, it's a podcast for inside companies. And companies will clearly pay for the the platform, the recording, the library, and the private feed that others can't access. That's for your company. And the companies that need this are very large companies. And so I don't know realistically, so I think that's all cool. I don't know realistically how many people at Facebook are like, fuck yeah, on my commute to work today, I'm going to listen to the manager podcast. Like, maybe nobody wants to hear this shit, but maybe they do. Like, maybe there's interesting personalities. I know that if Twitch had an internal podcast, I would do one. I would do one on, managing or product or innovation or whatever. I don't know. And I don't know how many people will listen to it, but I think it's a very interesting niche it's a niche of podcasting that is highly monetizable. What do you think?
Yeah. So on the surface, I think this is so badass. I've been a fan of this idea for a long time. I don't know where we came up with this idea, but I think that at the time we discussed this, we were like, oh, this might be one of the most straightforward ways to make a lot of money on this podcast at that time. I'm looking at
this. I think we were talking about it because I was publishing my 3-2-1 my 1-2-3 newsletter inside Twitch. I had told you, hey, here's a networking hack I'm doing inside the company. I write this thing, I send it to all the execs, like the 25 person exec team or whatever. And it's just a great way to stay in front of people and stay top of mind and help them get to know me. And it takes me 1 hour and I essentially get an hour with all the execs just by me putting the 1 hour in. But I was saying, I'm just sending this in Gmail. Why isn't there MailChimp or ConvertKit for sending stuff inside companies? That's kind of one of the ways we're talking about.
There's a great company called Recess. It's called recess.io.
Okay, I bet you grabbed it. So by the way, episode 53 is where we talked about it. If people want to go listen.
Episode 53. All right, I'm going to write that up because I'm actually doing this series where I'm going to go back and look at old ideas. And this is a good one. Recess.io. It started by this guy named Ryan Dice. It never really got off the ground, but it's called Easily Send Internal Email Newsletters and Track Results. So it's basically what we're describing. And it hasn't taken off. I'm also looking at Spoken. They went to Y Combinator. They're in class of W21. So winter 21. Does that mean they're still in it?
Yeah, that's now.
And they cut the company launched in 2000.
Actually, that's not even now. It's fucking spring 21. I don't know how that works.
Wait. Yeah. What the hell?
It says guys just lying.
It says W21. No, well, it could be winter 21. January 21.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
I guess. Not December. January. And it started in 2018. And I'm wondering why it hasn't taken off a little bit more. That's 3 years in. You would think it would have a little bit more traction. And so on surface, I think this is a brilliant idea. I'm wondering what's going on and why it's not kicking ass. I think this is a fantastic idea.
All right. I like this idea a little better as the newsletter one because I think it's just more accessible than podcasts, but both are cool. And we should ask Ryan Deese is your buddy, right? You should ask him what's the deal?
He's never told me this, but Ryan Deese has loads of companies.
Right.
So this is because this is pretty innovative. You'd have to be all in on it, I think, to make it work. And so I was wondering what's going on with
something like this. So if you're building this, let us know. If you're like, no, I want a project. I want to build it. This is one where if you're a credible person, me and Sam will invest in this, I think, to get something like this built.
By the way, we have a new email. It's called mfn@thehustle.co. I'll give you access, Sean. But basically, cool. because I get too many emails, and I think you do too. So if you guys want to contact us, and if you are building this, mfm@thehustle.co. So you can email us if you're actually making that. You want to go to another one?
Yeah, let's do another one. All right. So Crime Walk. Okay, what is this? So I don't even remember what this was. So basically there's like so Airbnb has this experiences thing, and you probably know much more about this, and your wife works there, and you're also, I think, the type that would do something like this. So I saw this and I saw how much money it was making, or I don't remember what it was.
What's it
exactly
called?
Okay. So if you go to Airbnb experiences, there was an experience, and in our doc, there's a link to it just slightly below, where it's a retired NYPD officer will guide you through a walk through New York. And
dude,
it's a guided mafia and crime walk. I'm like, wait, mafia?
I've been wanting this for so long. This is so cool.
So here's the description. I'm just going to read it word for word. First, let me say that most gangster tours in New York are total BS. This experience comes right from the horse's mouth. No tour guide, no filter. Get real stories while visiting notorious gangland locations as we walk from East Village to Little Italy, experiencing what it was like to be an associate of New York's famous mafia families. You'll hear firsthand accounts of the New York City mafia and crimes in New York, and taste local cuisines. So I saw this. I was like, this is such a good idea. I think I saw that this crime walk was making a lot of money. So it was very successful, which is not a surprise to me. I would do this if I was, you know, in New York. This is great. But a couple of things here's the business idea. So first is, this is cool. Quick reaction, then I have an idea.
Well, first of all, I just sent this to my wife because we're moving to New York for a little while. I said, we're doing this. Second, he charges around $120 to $130, depending on the date, per person. And in the description, he says that he has had 8,000 guests. So $123 times 8,000 is $1 million.
Exactly. So I think that's what originally caught my attention was, who has built an experience? I think that was my kind of curiosity. Who's built an Airbnb experience that has made $1 million, right? Because this is a big platform. Certainly somebody's doing well. And so this is kind of how it caught my eye. Okay, so what's the idea? The idea is, this is a cool thing for a cop to do in retirement. I told you we had that police situation where I had to go do a shakedown. We brought a cop with us and became friends with that cop later and was getting to know, you know, as the first cop I really become friends with as an adult. And I loved her. She was great. And so I was like, well, how do cops, can cops make more money? Cause she was describing how hard it is to be a cop nowadays. There's like, kind of like a lot of cop backlash because of BLM and all that stuff. She's like, but I'm a good cop. And like, also like budget cuts, like defund the police, but budget cuts are happening all around. And so anyways, long story short, I think this is a cool thing for a retired cop to do. Also could be applied to retired kind of anything. Anybody who has a cool job, like whether you're a SWAT officer, military veteran, firefighter, whatever it is. I think there's a lot of people who, are like me. We're like little weaklings that spend all of our days behind a desk, and we want this like safe way to taste, you know, an adventure and like what the real tough world looks like. And so that's why like Spartan Race and stuff, that's why they do well. And similarly, I think that these like kind of crime walks would be cool. So then I took it a little bit further. Well, why don't people do this with more things? So why don't you take every physical venue where something interesting is happening? Breweries do this, right? Breweries say, hey, we got this brewery, but we also have this side business of people come through, they get a tour of a brewery, they get to see how it's made, they get to taste the beers, they get to take some photos, they get to buy our shit on the way out. And they've turned brewery tours as a like additional income stream for breweries. So why doesn't this happen for more things? Like when I visited the warehouse for my wife's e-commerce business, I was fascinated. It's like this 80,000 square foot place. You get to see all these forklifts coming around and how it works, how the fulfillment works when an order comes in. How does it get put in a mailer? How does it get taken out of here? And so I think that for everything, factories, warehouses, police stations, firefighter stations, I think they should all have this as a business.
VaynerMedia did that I don't know about COVID anymore, but prior, I think it was like a $20 million a year business. It would cost $10,000 per person or per like couple, and you and your co-founder or you and whoever can go to the VaynerMedia thing, and they're like head of people would just to have a discussion with you, and then eventually Gary would come in for like half an hour, and all you do is you learn how an agency works, and you get to walk around the office and see like where the departments right. are, and you could go to the Eventbrite page and it would show you how many seats they had and how many were taken. And I did that and I just did the math. I'm like, oh my gosh, this might make like 10 to 20 a year if right. like if 7 of 8 of the seats are actually full. It's actually
and that was 10 grand.
Yeah, it's called if you look up VaynerMedia Eventbrite, you'll find it. It was called.
So,
yeah.
So this is I'm a small agency owner. Gary V is my hero. VaynerMedia is like where we want to be someday. I'll pay 10 grand to basically get to go check it out, see how it works, meet Gary, shake his hand, spend 20 minutes there, and then like leave. Is that basically it?
Yeah, it's called the VaynerMedia Daily Digital Deep Buy. Deep Dive. And if you look it up on Eventbrite,
name.
Yeah, it's a dumb name. Am I right, Abreu? Is that what it's called? And so if you look up Eventbrite VaynerMedia, you'll see it. And you could look at the past events and you could see how full it is and you could see the price. It's pretty ridiculous. Not okay, so ridiculous I don't bad, but like...
So I didn't look this up beforehand, but I'll tell you another version of this that's cool. Are you a basketball fan? Do you know who Coach K is?
Yeah, Duke guy. So, I know. Duke, I'm not an idiot, but I'm not a fan.
Okay, so
the four D's, by the way, it's called the four D's. It's called the four D's. VaynerMedia four D's. I guess that is Daily Digital Deep Dive.
Okay, cool. So, Coach K, who is the Duke basketball coach, he's the most famous college basketball coach probably of all time. And he was the men's Olympic coach for the dream, the latest dream teams or regime teams like LeBron and Kobe and all those guys. So he's a pretty popular guy. And, he does a thing every year called Coach K's Fantasy Camp. It's almost identical to what you're talking about. And now you got my brain spinning that how many more of these are there and how many more should there be? And, maybe we need the My First Million Dream Camp. So here's how this works. Coach K's Fantasy Camp, you pay $10,000 and you get to go. Who are these people? They are, you know, Duke students who like, you know, there's a bunch of Duke students who are like kind of investors now, CEOs of companies, and they were big basketball fans. Now they got a bunch of money. They're kind of in their 40s or, fifties, and they pay to go to this thing. What is it? You go for I think like a 5-day program or something like that. You go back to Duke campus and you live like a player. So you stay in the dorms, I think, or you stay kind of on campus or right next to campus. There's like a bus that basically brings you onto campus and you come into Cameron Indoor Stadium, which is the Duke basketball stadium. It's like the hallowed ground. And, Coach K takes you through a camp where you're on the court, you're shooting, you're doing the drills that the players do. You get the motivational talk that Coach K gives. He brings in old players to come. Oh, that's Carlos Boozer. Oh, that's JJ Redick. You get to autographs and kind of, but it's more intimate because it's 10 grand. So there's, a few hundred campers, I think. And so they actually get to meet those guys and actually hang with them. And for the players, it's cool too, because these are all like CEOs or high level hedge fund guys. They actually kind of want this business network also. And you get to wear the jersey. You get to go into the locker room. They play the sounds when you come out and you've got your dad bod, like your fat's coming out the side of the jersey. And it's
yourself,
like,
here comes
Duke. And you get to run out and there's like no fans there because it's not real again. Anyways, this thing's awesome. He must make a ton of money off this thing. I haven't really done the math because I heard about this when I was in college. My roommate was a manager on the team. So he was part of the kind of the team program. So he would stay during the summers to be the Uber, the shuttle bus driver for these guys. And he's like, I was like, why are you doing this? Sounds lame. Like, why do you want to do this? He's like, oh, I make a killing in tips. These guys will just hand me hundreds when they get out of for the five minute ride of like from the dorm or the hotel to the gym. He's like, I'm getting $100 from these guys every time I do one of these shuttles. It's amazing. And the network is great. Like I meet some of these guys. They're like, this guy started this. This guy started that. So I think this is cool. And I wonder how many more people do this or could do this because it's a very interesting little
niche. I think you do it for every sport. And I'm so into this. I don't know what I could do it with, but, I'm on board.
Here's a version of this. If you're a hustler. Okay. So if you're a hustler, here's what you do. You go to, Grant Cardone, you go to, people who are, yes, they've made it and they have a high profile, but they actually don't make as they still need money. Right. So like you can't, I don't think you could do this with LeBron James necessarily, but I think you could do this with a college football coach because college football coaches like, you know, at every program don't make tons of money. Dude, like,
or a really famous high school coach.
Yeah, exactly. Or it could be a CEO of a company or, you know, whatever. And you basically create the same sort of fantasy camp mindset or the 4D tours. And it's like, hey, I will run this whole thing for you. I just want 20% of profits. Okay, so here's what I'm going to ask of you. When I bring people over at this time every week or once a year or whatever it is, you come out, you kiss babies and shake hands, and let me do this. And so it's a way to attach yourself to an influential program, institution, or person and create this business line you know, from scratch, because really you're just offering this to their fans.
Dude, I think, and this is actually what I've thought about doing, because I enjoy physical work. Whenever I'm done working here, whenever I'm done, before I start my next company, I'm going to go and read a book, and I'm going to master like a niche, like crime in New York or the gold rush in San Francisco or something like that. Or I'm going to start a landscaping company, something that I'm going to have to be outside all day working really hard. And I think I can turn it into $1 million a year company like inside 6 months. Truly believe, and the reason why this fascinates me is because I love it. I love like being physically exhausted. I enjoy that. But also because I think that far too many people are trying to make money on the internet, which is cool and all, when they could probably crush it and become quite wealthy by just doing something outside that is totally like, it won't scale, yada, yada. I'm like, oh, fuck it, dude. First of all, everything could scale at least a little bit. And second,
I would love to see somebody do manhood as a service. Okay, what's manhood as a service? So in the same way that Spartan Race and Tough Mudder, they're kind of like these like pseudo tough guy events that you can go do. Oh, I did something hard outdoors. I got muddy. I got cut. You know, I climbed this mountain. I got this headband and I drank a beer at the end. You know, you get your man card. Now, anybody who really knows that this is not a real man card. This is a fake ID, but you know, this is your McLovin man card.
It's pretty funny.
But that's what these are offering. They're offering manhood as a service. And I would like to see somebody take this to the extreme. So I'll give you the example. Brother Aaron, who comes on here, he's come on here twice or something like that. And people know him because people like him because he's kind of a nut. Like he comes on with conspiracies and rabbit holes and he just goes all in on things. He is gone all in on like manhood. He's sort of like, dude, we're all too soft. So he trains like jiu-jitsu and boxing and he just wants to do an amateur fight. Why? Because he's like, I just want to see what I'm made of. And I think you could take that concept and make it a weekend traveling circus that goes from city to city. And you just say, step up and face some pain. You want to see what it's like to get like kind of tortured. You want to get, can you take a punch? Can you get like a Tough Mudder? There's the electric shock at the end. And you kind of want to know, like, what does that feel like? You know, like, can you go in this isolation tank and like, could you last an hour? I don't know what the actual product is, but I know it's a counterintuitive thing. It's like, wait, people are paying to get like, kind of like do physical labor. They have to like chop down this fucking tree and they don't get picked up until they're done. It's like, yeah, that's what this is. It's like hard work / pain / like manhood. Like what did we used to have to do that we don't have to do anymore? What's hardship that we are sheltered from because other people do it for us or machines do it for us or whatever? And I think there's actually like a very big craving in society for those types of experiences.
Dude, I totally agree. I've been going boxing every Friday and I just like love, I'm like, I need to get punched in the face so I can feel alive. I gotta do it. It's all
happening. Like again, like Tough Mudder, you make it safe enough where the mass market is pussies basically who don't actually want to go get punched. Like if you really wanted to go get in a fight, you can go do that. So you need the people who want to have the experience, but with padded walls, with the gloves on where you're not actually going to get like severely hurt in any way, but you get to experience like, what is your level of toughness, grit, pain tolerance, physical endurance, physical ability? What is your max? I think Survivor should do this. I'm a big Survivor nerd and I always see these challenges and I would love to do them. And like, if you're Survivor, okay, back to the camera, Jeff Probst, this idea is for you. You're Survivor, you're on season 42 or something like that. You're not getting any younger. The show is not getting that many new users. New viewers. Here's what you need to do. We need to create the Survivor World Tour, where you go city to city and you set up the Survivor events that you've seen on TV and you see, can you do it? Can you hang? What will this do? Survivor super fans have a deeper way to connect with you. They'll pay, shut up and take my money because I love the show. You can get the ex players to come out because they ain't doing shit anymore, right? They're just doing cameos. So they'll come out and they'll do it just to extend their lifeline of fame. You'll get new people who will go with their friends to go try this thing. They'll get into the Survivor universe. And then when I'm watching the show, it's like, dude, I did that one where you have to hang on to this pole for as long as you can. And it's an amusement park or a carnival or a fair, but branded by one of these shows or maybe multiple shows that get together and do this. What do you think of my idea?
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like it's like a TV version of Disneyland.
Yes, exactly. You take the IP from TV and you make Disneyland out of it. And like any kind of carnival or fair.
If they had like, do you remember, that TV show, The Challenge, that both you and Sean and my wife, Sarah,
do I remember the show I watched last week? Yes.
Yeah. They text each other about this thing called The Challenge. I don't know how it ended. I mean, I see it in the background when Sarah's watching it, but they love it.
I thought you were a fan. You didn't even watch the finale.
If I don't have anything to do, I'll sit with her and watch it. I have literally no idea how it ended. The ending was last week, right?
Yeah.
If they had a challenge location where you could do, I know there's a famous one called Wall Brawl or something like that.
Hall Brawl.
Yeah. We would have gone.
Let me describe Hall Brawl for people who don't know, because, there's not many. The crossover between people who care about business and tech and watch the challenge is, it's a lonely, lonely island. So Hall Brawl is imagine a narrow hallway, 2 feet wide. It's just plexiglass. So two plexiglass things with a 2 foot gap in between. And on one side, there's one person wearing football pads, another person's standing on the other side. And then the guy says, go. And you have to run straight at each other in this narrow hallway. You smash into each other. And then it's whoever gets out to the other side and rings the bell first wins. And it's the famous thing there. But this is exactly what I would do in my kind of manhood as a service fair or my TV fair, which is, yeah, you can do Hall Brawl. Come step up, sign the waiver, step up, and you get to do Hall Brawl. You get to experience this. There's video cameras already positioned everywhere, and you get to share this content onto Instagram at the end of it. Just like the Museum of Ice Cream, just like Tough Mudder, it's built for photo opportunities.
We're probably going to have to wrap it up soon, but I've got two stories that I'm going to bring up. The first is I was at my friend Nick Gray's house the other day, and I met the founder of Museum of Ice Cream. Told him, we talked about him, and he was like, oh, I know. And we were never disrespectful about him, but I think we were not bullish on the idea. So we'll have to.
I think we were both this is a great business idea, but hey, if you go, kind of underwhelming. I think that was both of our true user opinion of it.
So we're going to have him come on. But second, have you heard of Museum Hack?
No. What is this?
So I went to my friend Nick's house the other day, and I've been buddies with him for a while, and he's got this website called museumhack.com. He recently sold the business, but this is just another example of one of these tour things that we've been discussing. So I don't even know if he knows a lot about art. I don't know what his background is actually, but he just enjoys museums. And so he built this business that was making $2 million a year in sales, and you would pay him, or eventually he would train people in a variety of cities, and you would pay $50 to $100, I forget, the plus admission to the museum. And in New York, the museum's free. And he would give you a custom tour of a museum and explain to you the background behind the different paintings and different pieces of art. But he would do it in a fun way. So if you Google Museum Hack, the meta description is Museum Hack, fucking awesome museum tours. So it was clearly this young, right, hip, whatever thing. And companies would pay money to send their employees there. And they do it in six cities, I think. So they have people in LA, San Francisco, New York, and then a few other cities. And it was a $2 million a year business, and this is all that he did. And it was very successful. It was a lot of work to set up, but it kind of ran itself after a while. And pretty simple and straightforward and pretty amazing. It was called Museum Hack. That's the business.
That's cool. I like that one. You had two stories. Is that the one? Is that both or is that one?
That was both.
Okay, that's both. Can I do one more idea? Yeah. Do we want to try to slip it in? All right. So this is related to manhood as a service, more back to the roots, which I think kind of what you were talking about was I'm going to buy a farm. I'm going to own the farm, and I'm going to offer tours of the farm and let people come farm with me or a ranch or something like that, right?
And you're talking about Rent the Chicken? I'm looking at the site now.
Rent the Chicken is what I want to talk about. So
what?
I saw this little thing that's talked about how the chicken rental business has been booming during the pandemic. Okay, what is this? People are renting chickens, like pet. It's like a pet in a box. So chicken kind of owners, breeders, I don't know who, real farm people basically, are taking chickens and basically saying, hey, Sam, who lives in Austin and has his house, do you want a chicken coop in your backyard? Here's what you get. Hey, there's two chickens back there. Cool. You kind of got a little pet. I'll bring the coop. I bring the feed. I bring the instructions. I kind of boot you up. I let you know how it works. They're going to lay like 6 eggs, a day or whatever. Like, you're going to get fresh eggs that are awesome from your own coop. And you got this pet that's back there.
Oh my God, this is
awesome.
And
like, you get to talk to them and pet them and blah, blah, blah. And like, I know, for example, my daughter is like 18 months old. Like, kids love animals. And so I want to get her like some kind of animal soon. That's like because we have cows that come in our backyard or like to our fence. And it's like her favorite thing in the whole world is to be like, cow. And she says like, cow see moo. Like, it means like, I want to go see the cows. They go moo. And so I take her to the fence and she sees them and she's like, wants to touch them. And it's like her favorite thing. Our friend Ramon had a little chicken coop in his backyard.
Yeah, three of them.
Three chickens back there. And his son liked it. And they used to go out there and, feed the chickens and get eggs from them. And so this is booming. So they're all like sold out. So all the chicken rental companies can't get a chicken right now. They're all like totally booked. The demand during the pandemic like tripled. I think it's still small numbers because they were like, oh yeah, demand tripled. Last year we did 70, we had 70 chickens to rent, and now we have like 200 chickens to rent. So it's like, that's still not that many coops that you're renting out.
Pretty amazing.
But I'll call this is my new segment called Blue Collar Side Hustle. I may never do the segment again, but at least for this
one. No, we're going to do that. That's a good one. Blue Collar Side Hustle.
Blue Collar Side Hustle. This is a way to make a few thousand dollars a month.
This whole episode is Blue Collar Side Hustles, I think, actually.
Cool. So we talk about side hustles where it's like, oh, make a newsletter, build an audience, build a job board, build a website that does this, do drop shipping, blah, blah, blah. No. Blue Collar Side Hustles. Things you could just do with your bare hands. Make money with your bare hands. So here's how it works. Whatever city you're in, there's probably demand for these chicken rentals where you are too. If all these other ones are sold out, there's probably demand in those cities and in Nashville and in Florida and in LA and in everywhere. So rent some coops, basically go get some chickens and start renting them out to people who want to be connected with nature, have a little pet in their backyard that's low maintenance and get some fresh eggs. So I think this is a great idea as a simple way that you could be making, I don't know what it is, five to 10 grand a month of side hustle income through your blue collar side hustle.
Dude, and this website, Rent the Chicken, they also have a thing called Buy the Eggs or something like that. And you can find out where so Rent the Chicken,
yeah.
They put you a thing near you. And then they have a thing where you could find out where the nearest one is and you could buy the fresh eggs from your...
Which is cool, right? So you can go farm to table, but you're just in a city and you're just getting it from somebody who lives 2 miles away. They also do this with schools, which I think is, again, smart because kids love this. Schools and offices. Hey, are you a school and office? Great. We can do a 6-week program where you get chickens for 6 weeks. You guys get to name them, take care of them, pet them, blah, blah, blah. Kids are going to have fun. And then we move on, which back when I was in school, we had the same. We had like a class pet for like, everybody got to take them home for 2 weeks or something like that. So we had that. You have like a beekeeper thing or like you're a beekeeper. You have bees and honey. Maybe bees and honey is like another little genre besides chickens. But I think anything where it's a simple low maintenance pet that is unorthodox and ideally provides a little bit of food you can eat. So eggs, honey, something like that. I think that is a really cool, fun thing to do. Again, dude, your growth, you were working on growth. I said, I got to find something good. And then I just closed my eyes and started typing buttons. And this came to me.
This is very cool. So Rent the Chicken is not okay. So here's the price for Houston. Houston's near San Francisco. They deliver to you for free. It's only $285 for a 5-week rental, February to October. They deliver and set it up for free. You get 7 eggs that are going to be hatched. You get a box. I think you get 1 chicken. This is so interesting. What a
60
cool
bucks a week, right? 60 bucks a week to have a chicken or two in your backyard making eggs.
Oh, Rent a Chicken. Rent the Chicken is cool. I'm into Rent the Chicken. I went to a party the other day and they had a backyard petting zoo and like a petting zoo delivery service.
Was it a kids party or an adults party?
It was an adults party, and they had it was basically all the backyard. No, it just means they have chickens, they have a guinea pig, and I think that's and rabbits. Right. And that's what this reminds me of. Rent the chicken, backyard petting zoos. I'm into all this shit, man. I like all this stuff. This is a good one. I actually think this is something I might sign up for, but they're not in Austin. My friend who had a chicken, he said the eggs looked different, but they didn't taste different. Right. But I would feel a lot better eating backyard eggs than store eggs.
For sure.
Let me switch gears real quick. How do you stay focused? Because when I'm doing this so I'm all in on podcasts right now. Like that's all I think about. And it's almost all I work on. I have 200 unread texts. I've got hundreds of voicemails. I get phone calls from like salespeople selling me crap. My email is ruined. Twitter sucks. My Slack is constantly beeping. It is so hard to get in the zone and focus. How do you do it?
Well, I would say this. I am not a details person in general. So I would say one of the ways to stay focused, or one of the ways to get shit done, instead of saying stay focused, I'll say get shit done, is to correctly identify, like you said, the 80-20 of any project. So for you, you were like, for the podcast, okay, what do I ultimately need to do? I need to get people to smash the subscribe button. So how do I get more people to hit subscribe today, right? So you focused on the thing that matters, and you threw away the rest, and then you like did the what's the one step I can take today to like get that to happen more. And then tomorrow I'll come up with another one, and the next day I'll come up with another one. So that's, you didn't say it in so many words, but that's how I operate. I identify what is the thing that if I just did this one thing, it's going to get me 80% of the return or the reward or the impact. And then I try to just set out, okay, today I got to get this one outcome done. And that one outcome might have like five subtasks underneath. But I'm like, okay, if I can correctly identify the high impact thing, and then secondly, if I can just narrow it down, you know, make it a memorable, like I don't do a to-do list. It's one thing that I can remember in my head all day that this is the one outcome I got to get done. I'll find a way to get it done. It won't leave my brain. I don't let my brain get cluttered by all the 10 other things. And this bothers the hell out of my wife, or like right now, my mom's staying with us, right? She's helping out with the baby. And she's like, oh, you got to get your car insurance thing done. Oh, and hey, did you know your trash thing? We should upgrade the thing so you get the bigger bins because your bins are overflowing. And like all these people texted you because it was your birthday on Sunday. Did you reply to any of them? I'm like, no, I didn't do any of those things. I don't plan to do any of those things. None of those things are in line with my chief aim right now. So like, I'm going to like focus on that. And it doesn't matter what the chief aim is, right? Like we just had this baby. My chief aim was like, I'm going to be so helpful with this baby, because like I can see my wife, this is like, she's going to drown otherwise. This is too hard to have two kids under 18 months old. I need to be like Mr. Helpful. And so I like went all in on Mr. Helpful. But if it's a project, like let's say growing the podcast, that's what I would do. Identify the thing that will give me 80% of the impact, make it every day, just choose one high impact thing to do. Like it might be get booked on other people's podcasts, other big podcasts, because I know that's going to drive attention. Cool. I'll only do that thing. I won't do anything else.
So what you're describing, I actually wrote about this. I have this article called I'll Do It Later, Why You Shouldn't Worry About Procrastinating. And it was written in 2015. So I wrote this 6 years ago. And basically, and I stole a lot of ideas from other people, so I don't want to act like I invented this. But there's basically three types of procrastination. There's the first type, which is you do nothing. And that type is easy. A lot of people suffer from that. And that's what you want to avoid. You don't want to do number one. The second one is doing something less important than what you should be doing. A lot of people do that too. And that's basically when you know you have to do this school homework, but you play video games instead.
Right. No, it's like you clean your room. It's like you do some false productive thing when you didn't need to do that. You should have been studying for the test tomorrow.
Yeah, it's called it's busy work, and it's meaningless. Yeah. And that's actually the worst type of procrastination, because you actually think you're doing something productive. In reality, you're not. And that's really dangerous. But the third type of procrastination, I think we should all embrace, and it's actually the good type of procrastination. So it is when you do something that's more important than the stuff you should be doing. And that's actually what you just described. So getting your car insurance is actually important. But
What's more important, let's say this relates to business, it's just making a ton of money to the point where that car insurance kind of like it's you understand that it's less important. And the best example of this is like the brilliant scientist who accidentally wears two left shoes, or who forgets to shower, or who doesn't take their trash out. Is taking your trash out important? It's important, but it's far less important than creating the theory of relativity. You know what I mean? Right. And so
Balaji said something about this the other day, because we said, what's your day like? And he goes, he's like, or we said kind of like, dude, you're thinking about all these topics, like the future of X and the, you know, the future of Y and the past of Z. These are heavy, like these are meaty topics to think about. Like, how do you do that every day? And he was like, actually, that's not so hard for me. That feels like play. Like, I enjoy doing that. What's hard for me is remembering that I have a call I got to be on in 10 minutes and like stopping what I'm doing, getting there on time and remembering to go do that thing. He's like, cause I get completely engrossed in what I'm doing and that becomes easy. But what becomes hard is like normal life. And I was like, yeah, you are the absent-minded scientist who's got like his desk is like, you know, totally messy. It's like to someone else looks like chaos. But you know that you're piecing these things together and you don't care about organizing your desk right now. It's just not what's important to you.
And the thing is that logically, we all know that the third type of procrastination is good and you should actually embrace it. But the world basically tries to beat that out of you and they try to paint you into this corner and make you vanilla. And they say, but Sean, you have to do your insurance or you have to text these people back. And the answer is often, or it should be like, but why? Actually, it's far more important if I do X, Y, and Z. And I have found this extreme question, but helpful question to ask yourself is, will the task that I'm working on right now be mentioned or be part of me being mentioned in my obituary? And if it's not, then you're procrastinating. Don't do that. Work on the thing that will be mentioned on your obituary or has a chance of.
I actually got into an argument with my wife yesterday about this because we have some bill that's like, we have like a $700 late fee on it. And she was like, oh my God, we're so wasteful. Like, why didn't you just pay this bill? I told you about it. I put it on your desk. And I was like, yes, you did put it on my desk, but I was so knee deep in learning about DeFi the last 3 days. And hey, guess what? Like we've made, you know, $68,000 in 3 days in this DeFi trade that I was making. And like that's cash in the bank now. Like, could we not worry about the $700 thing? And so for me, it's so black and white, but she comes from a totally different value set, which is like, it feels worse to her to take something that was avoidable, that you could have just taken care of, that would signify adulthood, that you are on top of your bills. And for me, it's the exact opposite. My values are, you know, focus on the things that matter and like let other shit fall on the ground. And like that stuff is on the ground for a reason. I just hop, skip and jump around it. And so we are so different and we constantly get into these arguments. And I feel like financially I'm on the right side of history, but, you know, in the house, I'm definitely losing rounds every time we do these battles.
So if your wife is listening to this and
she
for anyone else,
by the way,
and my wife does, which is weird. But if show her this episode and to anyone else out there who like fits in this, like scientist type of forgetful scientist thing where they forget birthdays or they do this and they do this, but they're really actually focused on like some interesting thing that will actually change their life or others' lives. Let it slip. Let it slide. Do not give in to this societal pressure of like having to focus on these unimportant things, because you should instead be focused on things that actually matter. Your health, whatever you're working on, and your family. Everything else is pretty much bullshit.
Yes.
So
can I give my last piece on this? I know we're going to move on in a second, but I have 2 minutes on this, which is I made a choice a long time ago. The way I realized how this works is, there are people who are, there's unproductive people. They're just lazy. They don't get shit done. Okay. You don't want to be one of them. Then in the productive class, there's two types of people. There's efficient productive and there's effective productive. I'm effective productive. You're effective productive. There's a lot of people who we work with. In fact, we have to hire people that are efficient productive. What they do is they get a high number of tasks done, and done well, but they don't necessarily correctly identify the one or two tasks that are going to have disproportionate rewards, and they don't go overboard on those tasks. So if you look at us, well, that's what we're going to do, whether it's project selection or even within a project. We will find the one or two things that will drive the most returns. We will go give that 120, 180%, and then we will do 0% on the other things. Whereas another person might say, and by the way, that might all happen in a 2 hour burst of work in the day or a 4 hour late night binge. And the other hours of the day were completely, you know, we were scatterbrained, we were doing other shit and it didn't matter. There's other people who say, I'm going to work from 9 to 5. I'm going to make every hour count. I'm going to get a whole bunch of things done. I feel good because I plowed through my to-do list. I was so efficient. I used every hour properly and I got a large number of tasks done. And I tied up all these loose ends. That's efficient, productive. So decide which one you're going to be. Both have pros and cons. I think for a CEO entrepreneurial type, effective, productive is better. Or at least I've seen that's a more common path to success, I should say. So that's one. The second thing is, just like you said that there's procrastination, you left the Cody Sanchez podcast last time, but at the end we talked about this where she was talking about finding mentors, and I stole this Naval quote, which is so true. When people think they need a mentor to go do their project or to like start their startup, they're looking for a mentor first. It's just an advanced form of procrastination. You will find mentors along the way. You'll find people who are super helpful, who have experience. They'll open doors. They'll guide you. But that is not what's stopping you from making progress right now. And if you are looking for mentors before you do the thing, you are procrastinating. You're just doing it in a way that other people can't point and laugh at because you're not just eating Cheetos and watching TV as your form of procrastination. And the final point, there is a class of things. And right now, for example, I do this list. I've put this in my frameworks PDF that if you go sign up for my newsletter on seanpuri.com, this is the first thing I send you. It's my frameworks PDF. I have this like iron cross, or it's called an Eisenhower matrix. It's basically like a two crossed lines. And the up and down line is basically impact. So low impact to high impact. And the left to right is urgent and non-urgent. And so on a given day, you want to do the things that are urgent and high impact. So that's obvious. But then what do you do next? And once you do those two things, what do you do next? Do you go to the bucket that is urgent but low impact, or high impact, non-urgent? And what most people do, 95% of people, including myself on many days, is we'll do the urgent, low impact thing. We'll pay that bill. We'll call that person back. We will, whatever it is. Tie up those loose ends because they're due today or they're due yesterday. But there's a whole other batch of things that are important and non-urgent. They just sit there like ticking time bombs. And the great quote around this is that, what's important but non-urgent becomes urgent very quickly. And what ends up, it becomes urgent when it's too late. So like for me right now, this is setting up my tax strategy, my overarching tax strategy. How do I manage? Do I need an estate? Do I need a trust? How am I going to do all this? I don't know about that shit. It kind of makes my mind bend a little bit. It's easier for me to just avoid that because there's no specific day where I have to get that set up. But every day that I don't, I'm not doing something that's high impact or a very large impact thing. And so think about the things you do on this axis and then try not to just avoid those things that are non-urgent and high impact, because that's actually where a lot of value gets driven.
I'm doing all that shit now. I can't stand it. So I agree. I think we had a good little rant on procrastination, on productivity.
Okay, great. Good episode. That's it. That's a wrap. Abreu, give us the grade. People hated when we put the grade up front. I got like 5 messages being like, I prefer it. I prefer it at the end.
All right. That's good. All right, everyone. I asked you to either leave a review or subscribe and send me proof. And hundreds, maybe even north of 1,000 people did. I'm not going to read all your names right now, but I'm going to get to everyone eventually. But I want to give a few shout out, or I want to give a shout out to a handful of people that did it. So here's everyone who subscribed and sent a screenshot. If you want to get a shout out, you can do the same. My email is mfm@thehustle.co. So it's my first million, at thehustle.co. Subscribe to the podcast and send me a screenshot, and I'm going to read your name. So give a shout out to Sam Dickey, to Alex Khanna, to Apostolos. Ooh, this guy. I think he's a Greek guy. Apostolos D. Delandis, Adam Guskey, Ryan Bennett, Zach Rosen, Rob Borowski, Alex Rodolfi, Bryron Sanders, Will Sweat, Rob Phillips, Richie Dawes. And then here's a bunch of people on Twitter who hollered at me with a review and a proof of subscription. So Paul Halsop, Jimmy Moncrief, Warren SMP, Cameron Walker, Willie Soxy, Mooney Millions, Ms. McLean, Ellie Lager. Oh my gosh. I'm really sorry, guys. I just, for some reason, I have an issue where I struggle to pronounce certain stuff. Danny Dolly, K3 Goodman, Lewis Shulman, Dave M. Smith, Cheese 3, Solar Wolf, Faf Coffee, Wade W. Wireless, Landon H. 7. And that's it for right now. I'm going to get to the rest next week. But we'll see if this is even good and people like this. But go ahead and subscribe to the podcast. Send me proof that you've subscribed via a screenshot. Send it to mfm@thehustle.co and I'll try to read your name. Uh-huh. Yeah. I feel like I can rule the world. I know I could be what I want to. I put my all in it like no days off. On the road, let's travel, never looking back. Oh, yeah.